Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and in this age of tech startups and entrepreneurial idols like Mark Zuckerberg, starting a company may seem like a romantic idea. After just a few hard months of product development and lawsuits, you're a 20-year-old billionaire living it up in California. But Ben Horowitz says it's not that simple. Ben is a longtime Silicon Valley entrepreneur and co-founder of the venture capital firm Andreessen Horowitz, maybe you know it, whose portfolio includes Airbnb and Facebook and Skype. In his new book, The Hard Thing About the Hard Things, Building a Business When There Are No Easy Answers, Ben Horowitz argues that building and sustaining a company is a constant struggle. But he has a few tips for making it through the rough world of business. Ben Horowitz, thanks so much for joining us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
So before we get to the book, can I ask you about something in the news today from Silicon Valley? Any reaction to the news that the makers of the iPhone game Candy Crush value their company at $7.6 billion and are set to go public with shares at $24 a piece? Is this a company that you would have invested in?
Well, so they're doing tremendously well, and they're generating just a very spectacular amount of cash. For us, games are a little tricky investments. It's not our main area of expertise unless the game is, a kind of distribution platform or something like that. So this is like a spectacular success, probably in an area that we're just not smart enough to invest in.
I guess, well, or not, but because the context of my question really is that we have a lot of tech sector people who listen to the show, but we also have a lot of people who hear that number, $7.6 billion for Candy Crush. Facebook pays $19 billion to buy WhatsApp. And to be honest, people ask, where do these numbers come from on something that's just an app or a game and not some kind of product with a huge, business model? Do you like throw a dartboard and then multiply by a billion?
So I think that is probably trivializing it a little too much. I think that the thing that's changed, which has got everybody going, is that the kind of laws of, distribution physics in business have changed really substantially in the last probably 5 years and are accelerating in the sense that never before sort of in the history of business have you been able to reach, over a billion people very quickly. And in WhatsApp's case, right, they got to 450 million users in, I think, 3 or 4 years, and they were adding a million users a day. And that just hasn't been possible before. And so then you go, okay, so what does that mean? Well, businesses like WhatsApp monetize at somewhere between $3 and $20 a user a year. And you say, okay, 450 million active users and adding a million a day. That starts to actually add up from a math and a kind of revenue and a profit standpoint. And I think it definitely does take some getting used to. Even for me, who has kind of watched the whole thing, in that it just, like Henry Ford kind of gone out and reached a billion people that fast. And it's a brave new world in that sense, for sure.
Ben Horowitz, my guest, his new book, The Hard Thing About the Hard Things, Building a Business When There Are No Easy Answers. I see by going around the web that you've been getting a lot of questions about the whole how do you fire a friend section of the book.
Yes.
What's the story there?
Well, this is probably one of the more difficult things. It's interesting because one of the reasons I wrote the book was generally in business books, they tell you how to not screw up your company. But I really needed a book on, okay, once you've screwed up your company, then what? And how to fire a friend is very much in line with that. So what generally happens early on is you hire a group of very, very smart people, and they work extremely hard, and they build the company. I mean, on their kind of intelligence and effort, you kind of get it to a certain point. But then what can happen and does happen often is that they just continue doing the job that they had instead of, the job that you inevitably promote them into, and that doesn't work. You know, they just end up being different jobs. You know, running product management and being a product manager are not the same thing, or running engineering or being a great engineer are not the same thing. And so if you don't stop doing your old job and do your new job, there's going to be a problem. And then, you know, you get to this point where you end up having to fire people. And worse yet, they've been extremely loyal to you the entire time. So, and you know, they're your friends at this point. Like all you do on a startup, you know, a huge part of your life is building the company, maybe all your waking life.
Right.
And so it becomes a very, very difficult spot to even have that conversation. And so the book just kind of goes through, well, how do you even approach it? Because it is a betrayal. And it is something that, you know, they never expected to have happen, and it's going to come out of nowhere.
So let's talk about some of the more, and we can hear, of course, how fraught that would be.
Mm-hmm.
And on the more kind of positive side, your chapter called Concerning the Going Concern, about how you actually manage a company once it's sort of started to build. So what do you see as the biggest challenges or the biggest, you know, strategy point from what we can call phase two of a new business?
Yeah, so by far the biggest challenge ends up being kind of maintaining common knowledge. So, you know, when you start a company, everybody's on the same page because, like, there's not that many of you and you talk all the time, and everybody's kind of work on the same kind of problems. So once the company grows and gets to be, you know, 100 or 200 or 300 people, that becomes way more complicated. And this is where this is why you need all these things like process or a meeting or a conversation, is to get back to common knowledge. And, you know, and a lot of that ends up being based on trust, because communication and trust are very, very closely related, and that if I don't trust you, it's very hard to communicate with me because I don't believe that anything you're saying is true. And then if you trust me entirely, then, you know, some things can happen without me even saying, because you'll believe that I have your best interest in mind. So a lot of leadership is around building trust, and how do you do that, and how do you kind of maintain honesty even when being honest means that the news is not always great.
Listeners, we have time for a couple of questions. If anybody wants to call in, maybe you're in the first phase or the second phase or even later of trying to build a tech startup yourself or in any other kind of business, and you have a question for Ben Horowitz from Andreessen Horowitz, an author of The Hard Thing About the Hard Things, Building a Business When There Are No Easy Answers, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. I was intrigued by the office politics section of the book, your practical tips for minimizing politics in the office. And one of them was hire people with the right kind of ambition and build a strict process for potentially political issues and do not deviate. So what's the right kind of ambition to minimize office politics?
Yeah, so there's really kind of two kinds of ambition in business. One is, like, you're very ambitious for the company to do well and to kind of be part of a winning team. And then the other kind is you're very ambitious in the advancement of your career and, like, what you personally can do. And if you get, you know, you're always going to have some of the wrong kind of ambition, but if you get too much of it, then you end up with, like, a very intensely political environment that's super difficult to manage.
And the other part of that, build a strict process for potentially political issues and do not deviate. Do you have a good example?
Oh, sure. So, like, for example, a really great employee comes and says, you know what, I need a raise. And you go, well, you know, you are really great, and perhaps you do need a raise. And so you say, okay, like, let me evaluate that and give you a raise. And that seems okay, except for they got a raise not because you kind of evaluated the team and figured out where the company resources should go and, like, who should get what. They got a raise because they asked you. And so now you've changed, you've created a behavioral incentive that basically recognizes people who are very aggressive about asking for raises and penalizes people who are not. And so that is kind of just like a short, very like light mechanism to create what can end up being a pretty intensely political environment. A better way to do it is to have a policy on like when you evaluate people for raises and evaluate everybody at the same time. And, it's a simple thing, but it's a very easy mistake to make, and you can cause yourself like unlimited pain, and it's just unfair.
Cece in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Ben Horowitz. Hi, Cece.
Hi, Ben. How are you today?
Good, Cece.
Good. You guys got a great show. I love listening to you guys all day.
Thank you.
Well, I'm an engineer and inspector. I work as a contractor for New York and state of New York and state of New Jersey. I started my own business back in 1999. I changed over from IT over into engineering technology. And basically, I learned my engineering technical expertise in building bridges and highways. So I want to have my own company, but I want to bring other people in. And I'm a little trepidatious to hire my own friends or any people that I know because of what he was talking about, the difficulties of, being that boss. You know what I mean? Like, you got to tell them something, to do something, but they're your friends, and they expect you to be more kind to them or treat them a certain different kind of way, not understanding, the difference between business and pleasure. Like, it's for me, it's a little more difficult because I am not a business person at all.
Yes, no. That's an excellent question. So I give you two kind of tips on that. One is from Andy Grove, which is you can hire your friends as long as you're very comfortable firing your friends. But if not, you can get yourself into a very difficult position in that they might take advantage of the fact that they know you can't fire them, for one. Secondly, John D. Rockefeller said that he found that friendships based on business were far more profitable and long-lasting than the reverse. And that's definitely been my experience where, you can ruin a very good friendship by bringing them in the business context. So I think that you just have to, you really have to think it through, because in a business you have to protect the entire employee base. So if one person isn't doing their job, it's very confusion. The good of the individual must be subordinated to the good of the whole. And the good of the company has to be what you focus on as the leader of the company. And so there are going to be times when people have to go and there's nothing, there's nothing right. The laws of friendship can get in the way of that, particularly depending on how you view friendship. And so you just need to think that through very carefully.
Cece, good luck out there and keep calling us, okay? Susie in Greenwich, you're on WNYC. Hi, Susie.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a question having to do with investment filters. What is, since you have a super successful track record, what is your number one selection filter, if you will, that may not be as obvious as sort of the trends in business, profitability, all that sort of good stuff? What do you look for?
Is investment filter Silicon Valley jargon for making a decision?
Yeah, it's sort of making an investment decision, like what are we looking for? So I think there's kind of there's one on I'll give you two, one on the idea and one on the person. So on the idea, it really has to be a breakthrough for us to invest in it, in that it's got to be something that's really going to change people's behavior and adopt this new product. So it's got to be, at least 10 times better than the current way that people get the same thing accomplished.
Ten times.
Yes, at least 10 times. Because it's twice as good, people just won't change. That's not worth, changing what I do to get something twice as good, no matter what it is. But 10 times better, that will move people. And so it's got to be a breakthrough, a real change, not just something that's a little better. That's probably the number one thing that we're looking for on that side. And then, on the people, we're really looking for people with the kind of courage and intelligence to be original thinkers, to come up with things that other people might think are stupid and not believe in, but have the courage to do them anyway. And that's, that is a quite a rare thing in an entrepreneur.
And Susie, thanks a lot and good luck out there. I hope you make $1 billion. I'm not sure if you saw that Thomas Friedman column a few weeks ago where he talked to a hiring manager at Google about how they've started to rethink intelligence and things like emotional intelligence, adaptability, a key, more important than the right degree or training. Do you take that approach too?
They've been very, very hard on those things in the past. So that's, I would just say, like, very interesting observation on their part.
You agree? Is that too romantic a notion for you?
Well, I think that I think there's a lot of truth to that, and then I also, and I think this is probably one of the biggest kind of mistakes that people make with hiring is they go on too narrow a criteria. So they'll say, okay, I just need somebody, and particularly in startup world, like somebody who's just got a high IQ. People tend to focus on a lot, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they'll be effective.
Right.
And then there are a lot of other things that go into kind of product development and leadership and so forth. And, you know, IQ versus emotional intelligence for leadership, I certainly could make the argument that emotional intelligence on the margin is more valuable than IQ on the margin. I think that jives with, you know, my experience.
Yes.
But it is like emotional intelligence is not also not the easiest thing to measure in an interview. So they're going to have to get good at that as well.
We have a minute left. I want to ask you about something about mentorship, because next Tuesday we're doing a two-hour special here on coaching, everything from legendary sports coaches like John Wooden and Phil Jackson to the role of youth coaches, but also things like mentorship in business. So what do you see as the role of coaching in the professional world? Is it something you've sought out or would encourage a CEO to implement in a certain way in about 45 seconds?
Yeah, so I think coaching is a little tricky a word. It's kind of advice from somebody who has kind of experienced what you're going through, I think, can be fairly valuable. In our world, there's a lot of people who kind of coach CEOs who have not been CEO. I think that's more challenging. But I do think that having somebody to talk to who has kind of faced the issues that you're facing is extremely valuable. And actually, I have a friend who helped me with that when I was CEO by the name of Bill Campbell, who was very, very good at it.
And there we have to leave it with Ben Horowitz. Very interesting stuff around his book, The Hard Thing About the Hard Things, Building a Business When There Are No Easy Answers. Really enjoyed the conversation. Seems like our listeners got some stuff out of it. So thank you very much. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Brian. I enjoyed being on the show.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.